So to continue with John Hagen on 27 August 76.
Well, I was going to say that subsequent, or shortly after then, I don't recall the exact date, I was invited out to Caltech to spend a month or so, and while I was there, of course, gave a symposium or a colloquium on this matter of the hydrogen line and absorption and what one can learn by using these techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not really questioned on the accuracy of the conclusions that we drew about CAS, so that I think that they had accepted it.
And what year was that, you said?
Well, that was very shortly. That was, I think, after the Jadro Bank meeting, but it had to be before 1955. I don't know the know the exact date. It must have been 54, perhaps.
Do you remember any other things about this Jadro meeting as to the sort of the state of radio astronomy at that time? How it struck you?
Well, at that time, radio astronomy was carried out by a very small group of people worldwide, and everybody working in radio astronomy knew everybody else and knew them well.
Mm-hmm.
And so these meetings were always very pleasant occasions where people got together and reported their results and had very good discussions on the results and on the techniques. So you think back and you wish today that things were the way they were then.
Yeah, yeah. Rather, very different sort of science.
It's a much different sort of science.
Yeah. But I was thinking also of scientific issues, things that you might have learned from that meeting that you weren't aware of before, or was it just a...
Oh, yeah, but I can't tell you what they were.
Yeah.
At that time, things were moving so fast that every meeting you went to, you found something new, something mm-hmm. that you hadn't known before. It was a very exciting time in the history of radio astronomy.
You actually gave several talks at that meeting, according to my records here, about the 8-millimeter eclipse observations, S-shaped Cas A spectrum that you've mentioned already.
Yes, this is the thing I talked to you about, right?
The Cygnus A spectrum, the 9-centimeter eclipse observations in Sweden,
right?
Your 21-centimeter absorption. So that was quite a bit. I guess you were the NRL representative. Is that the idea for all these different things?
I don't know who else at NRL was at that meeting. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
My memory isn't that good.
Let's see. Do I have any other papers here that I haven't gotten? The only other one I might like to ask you about is that this apparently was what you got for your brightness temperature versus radius curve from the 54 eclipse at 8.6 millimeters.
You got a
dip.
Right.
Before the limb.
Oh, yeah, that's an important...
Could you tell me about that?
I'm glad you brought it up. That's an important thing. That bothered me for a long time because it didn't fit the model that I had constructed. And so I set about to see what one could do to explain that away, and that led me to think in terms of the spicules.
Oh, yes.
So if you assume a spicule model of the chromosphere, then you can demonstrate that you can have this, what looks like a double peak, with the inner peak not being sharp. At these millimeter wavelengths where the penetration is deep enough so that you see the spicules. And that is the first, demonstration that I had of the effect of spicules on radio radiation.
I see.
And from that I evolved a sp- particular model, but any further work there has to wait until a much more accurate 8mm eclipse observation is possible. Now we have recently we had two eclipse observations at 8mm, and I think by the time they're completely analyzed, we'll be able to say more about these particulars.
I was just noticing that at this Jodrell Bank meeting, that after you gave your talk about the 21-centimeter absorption, there were some comments by Lilly and Greenstein on a possible reinterpretation of the data for CASA in view of the distance discrepancy between radio and optical data. It doesn't say specifically how they want to do that, but I gather that they...
Lilly was there.
I gather that they wanted to probably reinterpret the radio data to make it come in line with the more reliable optical. Do you remember this at all?
No, I don't remember Greenstein's discussion at all.
Maybe it's actually recorded in the symposium itself. It's just an abstract here.
It may be.
Probably is. I'll have to check that. Okay. Now, if you could just expand a little bit on your work with the Vanguard. It's a very different field, but
yeah.
It got you into space radio. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm getting mixed up with Haddock. Haddock did a space radio astronomy experiment in the early 60s. I don't think you did any space radio astronomy, did you?
No.
Nevertheless, while we've got the recorder here and so forth, could you just tell me a little bit about that Vanguard program?
Well, the Vanguard program came out of, originated in a resolution that was passed by Percy probably about 1953 or 4, and it was agreed finally that an Earth satellite, or an attempt would be made to put a satellite in Earth orbit during the IGY. The National Academy picked that up and gave it support, and the thing through the National Science Foundation got congressional approval and some financial support. There was a great deal of fuss about who would do this, and a committee was established to choose between a proposal put out by the Navy, which was came out of my group, a proposal from the Army, and then a proposal from the Air Force. The committee looked at the available information, and on the basis of that, decided that support should be given to the Navy proposal. And so this Project Vanguard was started in the Naval Research Laboratory.
I see.
And since the work was came out of my division, they requested me to take over the responsibility for directing the effort. The commitment that we made to the Academy was that we would have a satellite in orbit before the end of the IGY, and the Vanguard program met that commitment. As you know, it wasn't as simple as all that, however, that there was a great furor after the Russians, who unbeknownst to us had set out to use their military equipment to really launch a satellite.
Right.
And they preceded us. The point that I think we ought to make here is that we were very we were very straight-laced about this thing. There was every effort made in the United States that the Vanguard effort be a purely non-military thing. We were not allowed to use military techniques. We weren't allowed to use the military vehicles. So we set out and developed our own vehicles, developed our own stages of the rocket and things like that.
And you say, you mentioned before that you went, actually when NASA was formed in 58, that, but this was after the
after
the first launch.
That was after, yes.
So it was done at NRL, so it looks a bit military to the outsider anyway.
Yeah, it looked that way, but it really wasn't.
Yeah. And you didn't know about it at all that the Russians were...
There was no indication to us that the Russians were preparing a satellite. I think that if you look at the record, it certainly was true to, it was known to our intelligence people, but it was not known to us.
Usual trouble with a big government.
Yeah. Right.
Nevertheless, did you feel some pressure in terms of that they might do it, and it'd be nice if the U.S. did it first?
Not really. If we had felt that way about it, our program would have been accelerated, because we wouldn't have attempted to do as professional a job as we thought we were doing in the end.
Yeah,
And we actually changed the design of our rocket to accommodate a larger sphere than we had proposed, which set us back 6 months or a year. Had we had an inkling that the Russians were pressing, we wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, just to get something up there.
It's probably just as well as it happened to go with it.
Do you think the Russians were inspired by this resolution that you mentioned at all?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. They did it as a part of their idea.
Also.
But they went at it in a little different way. They just said, we'll use the military technology we built up.
Now, why was there this U.S. philosophy? I mean, why couldn't you just buy a rocket from the military and stick your payload on it?
That's hard to explain. You get into a lot of odd people that they wanted this to be an effort of the scientific community and not an effort of the Department of Defense.
I see. Since it was IGY,
yeah.
I see.
And had the military done it, it would have been the nature of the thing would have been quite different.
Yeah. Now, I gather that you were not in favor of the military doing it either.
That's right.
Yeah. And now I must admit I'm a little bit fuzzy as to... The Vanguard went up in January 58, is that right?
March.
In March. After what, two Sputniks had gone up?
At least two, I think.
And that Vanguard was the first U.S. one? Or
No, it was not.
That's what I'm getting mixed up. Yeah.
Yeah. No, a Redstone vehicle, which was an Army device, put up the first U.S. satellite, which was an Explorer.
Oh, yes.
And I think that one went up in January or February, something like that.
So what happened is that once the Sputnik went up, U.S. people said, look, we got to get something
going crazy.
Yeah,
They were not prepared for the problems that any rocket program has in its development stage. And when they saw Vanguard had actually had a launch failure in a test vehicle, the very first failure that the program had after a long series of tests, when that was seen, just people started tearing their hair out. A fast sell was made.
I see. Did you have anyone at that time have any notion that in retrospect one would say that whoever put up the first rocket would be a tremendous amount of prestige in terms of being number one in science and all this sort of thing? I mean, of course, it influenced the whole U.S. educational system and everything after that.
No, not really. We were so damn busy getting the job done.
Yeah.
I don't think
you didn't see it as a particularly more influential than other important scientific projects. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
After the fact, you can go back and think, yes, you might. But at the time,
right.
At the time, we were really busy night and day.
Okay. Well, now I'm in my study. I'm going through the early 60s. Now, did you get back into radio astronomy at all?
Oh yeah.
Can you tell me about that, please?
I retired from NASA in 1963 and took a job at the Pennsylvania State University as a professor of astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And started a new program in radio astronomy there with, again, total emphasis on the sun. And so we had, over a period of 13, 14 years, a long series of accurate measurement of solar flux over a wide band of frequencies, plus two eclipse experiments at 3 millimeters and 8 millimeters.
I see. Well, what did you do right at the very beginning? Before 65, say.
Got a bunch of graduate students together and taught them about radio astronomy and had them build equipment. And so we got some equipment going on the sun right away.
And what sort of project was it, though?
By that, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, were you looking at bursts or?
Oh, no. Well, we were looking at bursts, yes, but also getting data so that over a long period of time we could extract flux information on the quiet sun. Because that's the important thing theoretically. What is the flux of the quiet sun? And you can't do that by going out today and just making a measurement.
Yeah.
You have to measure over a period of 10, 15
right.
years.
So that's what you've been doing at Penn State ever since. Well, in closing, do you think of any comments you'd like to make about the development of radio astronomy at NRL, or how it compares with other laboratories and so forth?
The only thing I'd say there is I was very pleased that the group at NRL kept on going as successfully as they did after I walked out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've done a good job under the circumstances of which they were. And it just makes me happy to see them do it.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing to see that some of the fellows who are there now go right back to the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is true, I would say, that during up until 1960 or whatever, 15 years almost, that all of this microwave stuff, there was very little competition, really.
That's right.
You were by yourself in this whole field, weren't you?
Yeah, and the only thing that was lacking was money. We never did have the financial backing to build the larger equipment that really was needed to make NRL stand very far out. The point is that NRL's budget...
Hagen also told me that he went up at an early stage, 46 or 47, and visited Covington's new antenna.
Yes, yes.
And knew about its operation even as the NRL one was beginning.
Hmm.
So that ends the interview with John Hagen on 27 August 76.